You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jemima Houston talking on, no mai haere mai ki te wire, mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Tuesday the 27th of July. My name is Jemima and I'm your host and I'm joined in studio by Joe, who is producing today. How's it going?
Good, good.
How's the morning been for you?
It's been fun. Today was real great. My piece today I'm very proud of and I can't wait to share with everybody.
Yay, cool. It's Joe's second shift, so it's all very exciting.
Number two.
E Whaiaki Nei, coming up on the show today, we do have some awesome pieces for you. So the rally was held in Tahiti and at AUT, commemorating the anniversary of French nuclear testing in the Pacific. Ina Manureva, who is a Tahitian language and culture expert from AUT and anti-nuclear activist, talks to Joe about the protests taking place. Dr. Benoy Kampark, who is a senior lecturer at the School of Global Urban Studies at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia, spoke to me this morning about greenwashing at the Tokyo Olympics and Paralympics this year. I also chat to Fiona Taylor from the Cuba Friendship Society, Auckland, about the latest unrest in Cuba and the misinformation about the protests that took place on July 11th against the government. Finally, Elizabeth McPherson, who is an associate professor at the University of Canterbury's Law School, talks to me about her study into how ecosystem-based management could make a significant difference to the way New Zealand regulates its oceans. He aho o whakaaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so tukupātui mai, you can send us through a text on 5395, or wae mai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Also, after the show, kaue e wariwari e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ke ene korero ano he pakihiri rokiroki, maranga i te pae tukutuku o rarangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Head up to the right of the page, click Bcasts, go to The Wire, and we're there. You can catch up with all the pieces that have been on the show over the last week and over the last wee while, to be honest. So if you miss anything, that's where to go. You can also catch us on our social media, which is 95BFM News. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Give us a follow, give us a like. Yeah, and keep up to date with what the news team is doing there. Let's get into the show.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Awesome, sweet. So on the 17th of July, a rally in Papa'iti, the capital of Tahiti, as well as here in Auckland at AUT, well, there was a rally in Papa'iti, as well as at AUT. I spoke to Ina Manureva, who is from Ma'oenui in Tahiti. Ina is an expert in Tahitian language and culture, as well as an anti-nuclear activist who helped organize the meeting. We spoke about the rally, the impact of nuclear testing in the Pacific, and its significance to New Zealand.
Tell us a little bit about the rally that was at AUT and as well in the Tahitian capital of Papa'iti. Was it last weekend or last week?
Yes, we decided to have in sync with what was happening in Tahiti on the 17th of July, which is what, 9 days ago. We chosen the 18th here for us, 18th of July, while in Tahiti the 17th, because that is to commemorate the Suntour nuclear test. And that one, Suntour, on July 1974, that's the one that contaminated more than 100,000 people, you know, in Ma'oenui, which is nearly the entire population at that time. So we commemorated on the 18th here, as I said, and 17th in Tahiti. Obviously, what we wanted to do was to work alongside the march in Tahiti, because in Tahiti they did, I think they started at 6 o'clock, and what they had was two different marches. One, so they get together, one was started from the east coast of Tahiti and one from the west coast of Tahiti. So they all marched all together from, I think it was 8 o'clock in the morning there, and they gathered. They just gathered all together at Tarahoi, which is the place where the assembly, the territorial assembly is. So while they were doing that, we were doing ours here with, in the background, we had the screen, you know, showing on Facebook. We took it on Facebook and we could see all the different movement, anti-nuclear movement, such as 193 Association. 193 is the number of nuclear tests that was carried out in French Polynesia. And also Moruroa Etatau. Moruroa, obviously, the main place, one of the sites, along with Fangataufa, where the French carried out as well the nuclear test. And the other partner there in Tahiti was the Maui Protestant Church. They were very much anti-nuclear. So that's what we did. We did ours here with inviting many speakers. I think I sent you the article. So
yeah.
Young and old generation of speakers to come in there. To have a speech to tell us the kind of message they want to give to the population here, at least to the public audience here at AUT.
Now, would you say that the nuclear testing in the Pacific has impacted the history of Tahiti?
It has impacted the history of Tahiti because, obviously, there have been some deaths, a lot of them, especially where I come from. I come from Manga River, which is the archipelago, the most southeastern archipelago within Ma'ahunui. I call Ma'ahunui French Polynesia. I rather call it Ma'ahunui because that's what the real name is. So we are down at the southeast, and we were the first to have been contaminated by the nuclear test, the very first one in 1966, called Aldebaran. So the wind blew down to us, those fallout, radioactive fallout, and we were the first people to have been contaminated. And we do have a lot of people still in Manga River dying or having to have medical attention for a number of years, chemo as well, because of that that radioactive fallout. So it has impact in terms of human lives, but it's not just, you know, Manga River, it's also all across Tahiti. People in the Tuamotus. The Tuamotus is the range of atolls where Moruroa and Fangataufa are, but that range of atolls, you can number them, maybe 90 different atolls, not all inhabited, but, you know, people are living there. So they have been impacted by the nuclear test. So a lot of the population have been moved onto Tahiti, so they've been forced to move to Tahiti because we needed to make sure that they won't be impacted, which is, you know, it did impact, especially from the, as I said earlier, from the Suntour nuclear test, it did go all the way to Tahiti. So in terms of human lives, a lot of people are still dying, and we are asking friends, you know, in terms of history, we are telling friends, you started in 66, all the way to 96, 30 years of it, but it doesn't appear in our curriculum. That doesn't appear at all. The children don't know about it. And what we're trying to do is to make sure that in the curriculum, especially in the primary school, we teach them, we'll tell them what happened here, at least in Ma'ahunui for 30 years. But also the aftermath, you know, 25 years later, we haven't moved much in terms of compensation, not only the human loss, but also for the environment. If you go to Moruroa now, well, if you can't, because it's now a no-go zone, Moruroa and Fangataufa. So the environmental impact is huge, especially when we know that they still have plutonium buried underneath the island. One of those big wells, I think 1 kilometer down, you know, underground, so 1 kilometer down the island, or the atoll, I should say. So both of them, Moruroa and Fangataufa, they still contain a lot of plutonium in there. and friends are just investing a lot to make sure that it doesn't leak. So the problem they have is that in terms of history, we don't know, especially the young kids, they don't know about what happened there. So it has impacted the history of French Polynesia, of the Tahitians, I should say, as a group, but the whole of nuclear West.
Do you see things like talking to the Green MPs, talking to the Department of Disarmament and Arms Control, as well as changes to the New Zealand school curriculum on how we can educate future generations on the issue as something that's quite vital?
Yeah, we do think that New Zealand needs to know a bit more about its past. But, I'm talking about this nuclear waste, but also, especially for the young generation, for those who are at school. It's not just that, New Zealand has stood up to many, many other challenges, People have stood up against the Dawn Raids, they stood up, especially people from the Pacific have stood up. So that's part of the culture as well of New Zealand. That's just, we are celebrating, we are celebrating. They celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Polynesian Panthers. But it's not just that. We need to look at the curriculum. I know that the Labour Party are looking at how to make the curriculum more about the history of New Zealand instead of having to look up to Europe all the time. We have our history, which is the case for us, in French Polynesia. We have to look up to the kings in France. It's got nothing to do with us. Young children don't even know their own kings in Tahiti or in other archipelagos. So the idea of bringing New Zealand back to who they were in the 80s and how they stood up is something that we need to call upon again, for New Zealand to stand up and to see that this place that is nearly 4,500 miles from here, or kilometers from here, it's going to come to us. It's just a matter of time. It's going to come to us, and we need the people of New Zealand, from all the Pacific, to be aware of this.
Ina also outlines that he is hoping France will look to compensate for those affected by the tests. Also, the rally organisers are also in talks with Green MPs, as well as the Ministry of Disarmament and Arms Control, on nuclear waste here in New Zealand. And we also have, they also talked to the Ministry of Education as well on the school curriculum for next year, in hopes that they will introduce some history on nuclear testing and the anti-nuclear protests that we saw in the 80s to the school curriculum next year. So.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Joe. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. Send us through a text. Tell us what you think of the pieces on the show today. 5395 is the number. We will be right back with you after a little break.
95BFM presents Diva Mahal live at the Hollywood Avondale.
Slither, cinder like a snake in the grass.
Silver Scroll nominee Diva Mahal is celebrating the release of new songs with her seven-day kinship tour across the country, bringing blues and jazz to Aotearoa. Supported by Georgia Lines, make sure to catch what will be a spectacular acoustic show filled with emotion and inspiration. Diva Mahal, live at the Hollywood Avondale, Saturday, August 21st, limited tickets available at Under the Radar.
Hakarongo mai, it's Māori words, because he waka eke noa, tau care. Awesome.
Whoa, dude, check this out. A sheep with a mullet. Oh, I love the news.
Tau kē. Reckon I could pull off a mullet? Tau kē. Awesome. Māori words. Karawhiua. Give it a go.
From Aristotle to Rogan, philosophers have pondered, what's better, good things or bad things?
Well, the results are in, and we're celebrating with Good Things Month all July on 95BFM.
Taking a closer look at conscious, community-minded, environmentally right-on businesses that are just better.
Businesses like
Lynette Menstrual Cups, a safe and hygienic reusable alternative to pads and tampons.
New Leaf Kombucha, New Zealand's only pure kombucha taproom.
Outlive, upcycling pre-loved clothing and textiles into one-of-a-kind bags.
And Be Nourished, New Zealand organic sauerkraut, kimchi and juices loaded with beneficial live cultures.
Good things are good.
Stay tuned to 95BFM all July for giveaways from our Good Things mates and so much more.
Go to 95BFM.com.
Don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
You're back on The Wire on 95BFM with Jemima and Joe. The 2020 Tokyo Olympics have caused a significant amount of controversy over the past couple of years due to the risks that COVID-19 poses to the athletes and teams involved in the Games, spectators, and, of course, the host city, Tokyo. For months leading up to the Games, polls have shown that the majority of Japanese citizens did not want the Olympics and Paralympics to go ahead in Tokyo, and large protests have been taking place in the streets of the city, with citizens angry that the Games have continued, despite the COVID-19 pandemic still being a massive elephant in the room. Another issue that comes with the Olympic and Paralympic Games that you may or may not have thought of before is greenwashing. Dr. Benoy Kampak is a senior lecturer in the School of Global Urban Studies at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia, and he says that the sustainability and greenness of the Games is an act of theatre. Even though the International Olympic Committee has made strong commitments to ensuring the Games are carbon neutral or even carbon positive. I spoke to Dr. Kampark about this issue of greenwashing, how sustainable this year's Olympics truly are, and what it would take to make this huge sporting event a leader in environmentalism. I began by asking Benoit to explain what greenwashing actually means.
Yes, so greenwashing is the concept used essentially to give the impression of genuine environmental and ecological change. So it's the idea that you are implementing policies and strategies to actually improve, a degraded situation in an environmental sense, but you're not actually doing so. It's very superficial. And I think since the topic we are looking at is with the IOC and the Olympics, it's one of the classic examples of how greenwashing is implemented, and in the sense that they are very good theatrically about advertising environmentally green and sound policies. But when you start teasing them out, you realize that that's not quite the case. There is a lot of show taking place, a lot of theater.
So let's talk a little bit about what commitment the IOC has actually made to sustainability, just to sort of start us off on why greenwashing is a problem for the IOC.
Well, the IOC has been in this, dare I call it, the green game for quite a long time. It already in the 1990s, and it was certainly in response to the UN Agenda 21, the Olympic Committee, the IOC, was interested in adopting their equivalent of Agenda 21, which was to center the nature, if you like, or the environment at the center of Olympism, as it's called. Juan Antonio Samaranch, of course, the former IOC head, was very much keen on that. And then since then, there have been various articulations of committing the IOC to carbon neutrality and sustainability goals and so on. So in terms of their projected line, they've actually said that, for example, games like Tokyo 2020 and then the forthcoming Winter Olympics and then essentially right up till 2030, where it won't be just carbon neutral, it'll be carbon positive, so they're actually talking about, in the sense of how environmentally good they're going to be. So they've made various commitments, they've made various political or policy objectives, the building of a so-called or planting of a so-called green wall in Africa, the planting of forests, their arrangement with the Dow Company. And all of these are supposedly meant to achieve decarbonizing the environment and having sustainable games.
Now, let's talk about this Olympics, the Tokyo Olympics, currently taking place. It has been said that this is the most innovative games in history. How green are the Olympics and the Paralympics this year in Tokyo?
Well, this is the interesting thing. If you were to read the IOC dispatches, and if you were to read a lot of coverage on this, you would see the following things mentioned. You would see, for example, the focus on zero wasting, maximum energy savings. These are the words of the IOC, by the way. The restoration of biodiversity, all these goals. And then you would see various specific things done by the IOC Committee of Tokyo, the recycled plastics being used in white T-shirts and trousers worn by the torchbearers during the opening ceremony, the Olympic flame itself being itself, made out of recycled materials, and of course, the famous beds, the so-called the recycled cardboard beds that I'm sure you're probably familiar with, yeah. Many of your listeners, that are meant to, the 18,000 that have been actually made by the Japanese bedding company Airweave, and 8,000 of those are supposedly going to be repurposed for the Paralympics. And then, of course, the medals themselves have been made from, metal extracted from iPhones and so on. So we've got the image there, we've got certainly a lot of advertising, but when you look at the actual positioning of where Tokyo is relative to even previous Olympics, it's actually not particularly very sound in that. In fact, there was a study done in April, which was published in the journal Nature Sustainability, that showed that Tokyo ranks actually rather poorly when you consider the authors there looked at 16 previous Olympic Games and found that essentially they've been getting progressively worse. And the reason they're getting worse, of course, is because they're getting bigger and there's a greater emphasis, as it were, you know, on these size events, even though the rhetoric, of course, is very much in terms of the green type that we would expect to see or hear.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about COVID-19 because there have been protests about the Olympics taking place at all, and COVID-19 has already impacted the Olympic Village. It's clearly having a significant effect on the Olympics this year. So how has COVID-19 potentially impacted the greenness of this Olympics? You know, there are not very many people watching the Olympics. These huge stadiums have been built in Tokyo, and no one but the athletes and their trainers are using them. Does this impact the greenness of the Games?
Well, there have been some ironic effects, and I think this is even beyond the Olympics. The COVID-19 pandemic has, with, of course, the imposition of lockdowns globally, the cessation of many economic activities and so on, has led, you know, oddly enough, in many instances, to a bit of respite for the global environment. So in a funny sort of way, COVID has actually inadvertently brought in an element of greenness to things. And ironically itself, the same thing in Tokyo, with the fact that there are fewer spectators, you know, and they're just dignitaries, officials, people staying home. That in itself has its odd environmental effects. But as you rightly point out, the infrastructure has been built, it's there, the services are there, and so on. So the fact is that, you know, it will be interesting to see what happens with COVID as to how they how games like this are going to be approached in future.
We're talking about the future and how the games might look in the future to obviously deal with COVID-19, but then also work better for a more sustainable future for a massive sporting event like this. Could you just briefly touch on those points about what needs to change to make the Olympic Games truly a sustainable green event?
The only way that it can be a truly sustainable green event is that size, well, size does matter. And the IOC will have to accept something that it has had enormous difficulty doing, given what we've said, what we're talking about before with revenue, with broadcasting and so forth, the enormity and scale of things, that they will have to have a pared down event. And that means, of course, fewer spectators. It may even, God forbid, mean fewer athletes, fewer dignitaries. So all of those things the IOC simply does not want to hear. So the first thing, the event should be smaller. There are fewer spectators. You know, there have been suggestions that spectators, you know, they could be given a more digital experience, for example. So, you know, more innovative ways like that in future Olympics, so that we have fewer stadia facilities and so on. Another idea is this notion that you simply rotate it amongst existing cities who have either hosted it and have the facilities and the means, and that minimizes disruption to infrastructure and dislocation to those residents and people in those cities. And then, of course, thirdly, which is very important, that the goals and the objects are being actually met in a way that's accountable, because one of the huge problems with the IOC and also with the committees of the cities hosting the games is that they're simply not accountable for the actions they take, be it financial and so forth, be it in terms of whether they have green policies or not. And precisely because of this lack of accountability, an agency or some independent body verifying that this is being done would be another useful way of trying to cope with the problems of whether an event like this is green or not.
That was Dr. Benoit Kempmark, a senior lecturer in the School of Global Urban Studies at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia, speaking about the greenwashing of the Tokyo 2020 Olympic and Paralympic Games. You're tuned into The Wire on 95 BFM. We will be right back with some more pieces for you. But first, here is, and I'm going to absolutely butcher this, but here is Chondromalika Patella by Black Midi. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. We will be right back with one last piece for you after a little break.
Southbound Records, New Zealand's largest range of new vinyl, a fantastic curated selection of secondhand, plus all the accessories you need. Brushes, cleaners, sleeves, crates and more. Their in-store experts can help you out whatever genre you're into. So support your local and head into Southbound today. Southbound Records, your vinyl specialist. Pop in at 132 Simon Street or order online.
95 BFM Breakfast is good for your health. And to prove it, they're giving away a Be Nourished health food pack on the show every day this week. With one Be Nourished kimchi, one Be Nourished sauerkraut and one bottle of Be Nourished gut shot. Just internet surf your Be card and stay tuned to 95 BFM Breakfast all this week for your cue to enter. Three cheers for intestinal welfare. Woohoo!
We'll be right back. their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
You're back on The Wire on 95BFM. What you just listened to was Lemony by T.G. Shand. We have one last piece for you today. So the University of Canterbury's University of Canterbury Associate Professor, Elizabeth McPherson, and Lincoln University's Dr. Steve Ehrlich are a year into their project called Policy and Legislation for Ecosystem-Based Management. Now, that might sound a bit sort of broad, but what the project aims to do is to provide options for reform for our government when it comes to marine and ocean legislation, basically looking for a way to connect all these different disciplines that relate to the ocean to have a better connected system for regulating our marine and ocean areas to ensure that it continues to be a great place for New Zealanders to enjoy in whichever way that may be. I spoke to Professor Elizabeth McPherson about the study. She explains what the purpose of the study is, and then we talk a little bit more about why an ecosystem-based management system would work well for New Zealand's legislation. I began by asking Liz to explain what the research is all about and its purpose.
My project that I co-lead with Steve Ehrlich at Lincoln is part of the National Science Challenge that looks at sustainable seas, and that is a government-funded project which in fact runs over 10 years, but I'm involved in the second tranche, which is the current 5 years. And the challenge has adopted sort of the goal or the vision of supporting ecosystem-based management of oceans, marine and coastal areas in Aotearoa New Zealand. And there are many different projects within the challenge. Some of them are more scientific. They might be focusing on things like, you know, how do we protect shellfish beds within our harbours, or how do we ensure that we don't overfish certain areas, or how do we protect marine reserves, or those sorts of more scientific or ecological questions. But my project is a legal and policy project, and we are taking all of the scientific research and then saying, well, what does that mean for the rules that we are making in Aotearoa New Zealand about how people can use marine and coastal areas, the rights that people have in marine and coastal areas, but also the obligations that government and private people have to look after marine and coastal areas. So the objective of our project is a 3.5-year project. The objective is for us to develop options, which we will put in front of the government, and will hopefully feed into the government's reform processes around environmental management at the moment, and hopefully lead to some change in laws and policies, at least some tweaks to the existing laws and policies that we have. And it's an interdisciplinary project, so we have scientists, lawyers, policymakers, all coming together from around Aotearoa New Zealand working on this goal.
Has there been previously such a multidisciplinary focus and environmental focus when it comes to marine or water-based regulation? Is that typically a consideration when it comes to policymakers making legislation, or is it generally quite, I don't know, by the book, sort of dry?
Yeah, there's a definite moment happening in environmental regulation and marine and freshwater at the moment in New Zealand, where we're saying we do need to take a multidisciplinary approach. We do need to combine our knowledge across sectors. So, for example, in a particular harbour, you might have rules or laws about fishing. You might have rules or laws about protecting marine mammals, dolphins. You might have rules or laws about how you use land next to the coast. And traditionally, those things have all been regulated in silos. So different parts of our government and different parts of our community have focused their energies on these things separately. And it hasn't been a very good coordination between those things. But we know from the science that ecosystems are interconnected. what you do on the land and coastal areas has a direct impact on the harbour. You know, if you're doing earthworks next to the ocean, there's sediment that runs into streams, that runs out into the harbour and affects the living organisms that live in that space. So it doesn't make sense for our rules and our policies and our legal systems to operate in silos. There definitely is a recognition of that that's a problem in Aotearoa now, and we now have a Minister for Oceans and Fisheries who's established, just recently released a new vision for the ocean, which recognises the connectedness of that system and the need for all of these things to talk to each other. So our project is, I suppose, coming at a very important time where there's a lot of interest in this, but there's a need for research about how exactly do you do that? How do you bring together different parts of and different levels of government and community and industry and get them to all talk to each other and work together?
That was what I was going to say. I can imagine it seems like quite a big task to look at all those different rules and regulations that currently exist and find a new way to connect them all. Like, how do you even go about changing legislation like that? Because the other factor is that policy and rules and legislation, it's a slow process to get those things moving and changing through Parliament. How long are we going to have to wait for a ecosystem-based management approach to marine regulation and laws?
Yeah, and that's a really important point, because we actually can't just continue to wait another 10 years or another 15 years to get reform through to all of these different pieces of legislation, because the environment needs us to do something now, because we're seeing, you know, significant impacts in our marine and coastal environment. We're seeing what scientists call tipping points being passed. So in the first year of our project, so we're just over a year in now, for the first year we had a very detailed look at what's been done around the world and other parts of the world to try and move towards an ecosystem-based approach. And one thing that we found was that attempts to try and sort of legislate away from this fragmentation through a one-stop shop kind of approach has not really worked anywhere. So we think that embracing the, I don't know if the word is fragmentation, but embracing the fact that there are going to be lots of different people with different interests in the marine and coastal environment, that's always going to be there, that diversity is always going to be there. So we should in fact focus on the processes that bring people together and that support the relationships between people and marine places. So perhaps we don't need to a wholesale reform. Perhaps we don't need to do away with all of those existing laws and create a new law. Perhaps we can devise processes and institutions and practices that bring all of these diverse people and interests together.
You're a year in now, and so you've got another 2.5 years until the end of the project, is that right? So
yep.
What would you like the end outcome to be?
By the end of our project, we want to have a number of options that we can publish in academic research, but also in communications that are targeted to our partners and our Māori partners, our stakeholders in government, that provide some different ways that the government could go about enabling an ecosystem-based approach. And that could be mostly through processes, institutions and practices, or it could be through some broader legislative reform. But our project has also been quite closely co-developed with our partners and stakeholders. So we're working with government, with Māori, with iwi and hapū, and with industry, in the hope that they will feed into the development of those options, and that's more likely then that those options are going to be taken up one way or another. And as I said before, it's really timely because the government is at the same time embarking on its reform of the Resource Management Act and its oceans reform. So we're really hoping to feed into those processes with our options. And then it's really, it's up to the New Zealand government and it's up to the New Zealand community to decide, you know, what's right in terms of where the balance needs to be set.
That was University of Canterbury Associate Professor Elizabeth McPherson speaking about her research, policy and legislation for ecosystem-based management, and that is for ocean and marine legislation reform.
That was The Wire.
That was the Tuesday Wire for another week. Thank you very much to all of you for tuning into the show. We love hearing your texts and your calls, so always let us know when you've got something to say on The Wire. Thank you very much, Joe, for being a wonderful producer. How'd you feel today, Went?
It was really great. I think we had some really great stories today.
Absolutely, and we'll have some great stories for you next week. So stay tuned to The Bee, and up next is Jen with the 1 to 4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.